chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Well, last year about this time, Tom and Susan Ross slipped into town. It was in December, and Tom preparing to become president of the University of North Carolina on January 1st of this year. We talked about all kinds of things, mostly the soft stuff about moving into the new house, but also about some of the things that you were facing. And Tom, thanks for coming back to sort of reflect on your first year.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm glad to be here.
Well, this time last year, it was preparing for Christmas, and you were moving Christmas decorations from, as I remember it, moving Christmas decorations from Davidson to Charlotte, setting up and having a kind of, I would just have to say, looking back on it, it was kind of a disruptive Christmas season, wasn't it?
Well, it was a little. Although we ended up with a beautiful tree, and though we didn't have furniture quite where we needed it, I remember having our family with us and sitting together on dining room chairs and whichever ones we could pull into the foyer and opening presents and being together. And, you know, that's really what Christmas is about, is being with your family and having an opportunity to celebrate with them. And we had that opportunity. So it was a busy time for us, obviously, moving from Davidson to here and emotional as well as busy. But we made it through it great, and we're really pleased to have a good holiday.
We're going full circle for a year. The year swept by. I mean, you hardly had time to take a breath. Is December and Christmas going to give you the time to pause and finally get 10 minutes to take a breath? And
I think that may be a little premature yet. We have still lots of very significant issues that we're facing, and it's been a challenging year. There's no question about it for the university and for me personally. But we're making progress. I think it's never as fast as you want, and it's new issues pop up every day, and so there are always challenges. But we have some still major issues facing us over the next few months, and we've got to keep our eye on the ball during even through the holidays to be sure that we're dealing with them in a timely manner. So I'm sure we'll get a little bit of a break. I think we're going to try to actually slip out of town and maybe go up to Washington, D.C., where my son and his wife are, and spend some time with them. Unfortunately, my grandson's not going to be with me on Christmas Day, so that's the downside.
Tell us about your you've got a lot of friends in Chapel Hill, and a lot of them know your children pretty well, or some of them know your children pretty well. Tell us about your kids and your grandchildren.
Well, thank you. My daughter, Mary Catherine, and her husband, Chris, live in Charlotte, and they own a sort of specialty running store called Run for Your Life, and so they sell running apparel and tennis shoes, and they've owned that store together, I think about 5 years now, and every year they've seen their sales grow up, and they're doing
a regular retail business, which most of our friends who are in that business are struggling.
Yeah,
with the internet purchases and running particularly, you can. Convenient.
You can buy anything anywhere almost without going in a store. But they provide really good service, and Chris is well known in the running community around Charlotte as somebody who really knows the industry and knows how to fit people that are distance runners with the right shoes. And so they sponsor some marathons down that way and are really involved in the running community, and so they've done very well actually, and even considering expanding the store a little,
that's got to be fun for you.
It's really great to watch them, and they have our only grandchild, Nolan, who's just turned 2 years old, and he's a lot of fun. And so, you know, one of the tough parts for us personally of leaving Davidson and coming here was we were 20 minutes away. Now we're a little over 2 hours away, so we don't see them
perfectly. We're fortunate enough to have the younger grandchild who's about that age. And that year of development between one and two is an extraordinarily interesting time.
It really is. And so it's harder to be further away from them, but we still see them relatively frequently, which is great. My son, Tommy, and his wife, Lindsay, live in Washington. And so the good part of moving to Chapel Hill is we're closer to them. So
what does Tommy do?
He is the senior advisor for intelligence and defense for a U.S. senator and for the Senate majority. Party leader, actually, and so he's in an interesting world and loves what he's doing. He loves the policy part of it and is actually now back taking some courses in at the National Security College in African security, which is an area of interest of his.
Wow.
And then his wife Lindsay is a senior policy person at the Department of Agriculture for the Secretary of Agriculture. She's actually thinking about going back to graduate school and is she has a master's and she's looking at going back and getting a PhD. So they're happy. They bought a house up there and seem to be both working hard and enjoying life.
Well, it's sort of following in your footsteps, but getting stuck at the first stop. In the sense that you would. Worked as a staffer.
Right. I mean, he's been there a pretty good while now. He just turned 35, and 35 is an old man in Washington on the staff up there because so many of them are 22 and 23, and people go and stay 2 or 3 years, and then leave. That's certainly what I did and what many did, although I started a little later than some. But he's been there now a pretty good while, and so he's got a lot of experience, and he's sort of found his niche and is I think, highly regarded within his field, and so and he really does enjoy the policy work, and he does sometimes more travel than I would like because he goes places that I kind of wish he wouldn't. He just got back from Yemen, for example, and was telling me how he could not only hear but watch the tracers on the bullets outside his hotel room. And of course the very next week or actually a few days after he left Yemen was when the president resigned. So he's in and out of places like that in Afghanistan and Iraq in one place or another. But, he really does enjoy what he's doing.
Golly. Well, that's great. Well, when we moved here, I found that my children who were at that point younger than yours are now, but it was disruptive in the move, but the idea of being in Chapel Hill was a place that they enjoyed coming to visit, and it worked out pretty well. Do your kids like to come here? Or they got time to come here?
They both like to come visit us, for sure, and they both like coming to Chapel Hill, for sure. Both of my kids, as you know, went to Davidson, and so my daughter loved coming there, and it was closer. But for my son, it's obviously closer for him to come here than it was there, and he loves coming here. He's a big Tar Heel fan, and so he likes coming when he can to games. His problem is he and his wife both work all the time, and so they don't get down
often. In that respect, they're like you.
Well, there's some of that in there. I think that's one of the bad sides they may have inherited,
don't want to give away any of your secrets, but I enjoy seeing you and Susan sometimes early in the morning walking, usually walking. I don't know. Are you still running?
I am still running some.
Which is, I think, a great thing to do. But what else do y'all do for fun? I mean, or do you have any time for fun?
What's that word? No. We do. And, the reason you see me running sometimes and both of us walking sometimes is she doesn't like walking in the dark. So in the wintertime, you might see me running and see her walking later. But I can't wait for her because I got to go to work. But, that's good time for us because it gives us a chance to catch up and figure out where each of us are in day-to-day life. But we love going to the mountains. We have a little place up there, and if we can get away and go to the mountains, we love that. She spends a lot of time up there in the summers, and because it's the weather's better and cooler, and I try to get up when I can, so we enjoy that. I've been a fly fisher person for a pretty good while, and in the last 15-20 years she's gotten interested in that and enjoys that.
Me too. This is your program, but I got it. I mean, I tried to learn how to fly fish, and so we went to one of those sort of tourist ponds, or tourists alongside the stream, and so they have some very friendly trout who will
jump on your hook.
Well, so in my crowd, that they jumped on everybody else's hook by 10 o'clock in the morning. But it took to lunchtime before they finally persuaded one of them to get on my hook. And they said, all right, well, we told them that we weren't going to feed them until this last guy got on the hook. So I don't think I'm ready to learn how to do that. What's the secret of
you know, I think the first and most important secret is not to worry about catching fish, and to realize that this is an experience. And it's an experience for me that's always takes place in a beautiful place, because wherever you're fishing for trout, it's going to be beautiful. You're going to be in the mountains probably. You're going to be on a stream that's oftentimes remote and beautiful, although I fish through the middle of the town too. But it's usually a very beautiful place where you are. And for me, once I get on that river or that stream, and part of it's the noise of the running of the river, but part of it is the concentration required to watch that fly as it's on the water and looking for a strike. And I think it just frees your mind from everything else. You're focused on nothing but that fishing. And so for me, it's kind of an instant relaxation. It's the only way I've found to just kind of instantly relax. It's one of the few things I can do that I don't get distracted thinking about work or getting itchy to go back to work. You know, I mean, I can't stand, I'm too type A to be away too long. But I believe I could fly fish for days at a time and not worry about work if I had the chance. But it's just a great way to relax for me.
And what is it like when you do get a strike?
Oh, it's nothing more exhilarating. You know, you're watching that fly, and I love to dry fly fish, which means the fly's on top of the water, and so you can see, and the rivers are usually pretty clear. You can see that trout come up, and oftentimes and take that fly, you know, and you set the hook, and it's a pretty exhilarating thing to have happen to you, and it's great fun. You know, I only fish nowadays catch and release, so I always put them back. And that helps you, I think, when you are having a day where you're not catching many, you realize, well, even if I was catching them, I'd be putting them back. So,
well, I guess that's right. But I mean, is do you never bring one home and eat it?
Oh, occasionally I do. And of course, you can buy fresh trout in the grocery store now that are about as good as you can catch on the stream, although the ones on the stream are a little fresher and a little better. And if I'm camping somewhere and fishing and there's a ability to keep them under the rules, then I will sometimes. But you know, a lot of fishing I do is in catch and release water. And
that you have to.
You have to release them.
Rules
yeah.
require that. Well, we're visiting with Tom Ross, the president of the University of North Carolina. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with DG Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. I'm visiting with Tom Ross, the president of the University of North Carolina, and sort of on the first anniversary of our first visit when you were slipping back into Chapel Hill, getting ready to assume the responsibilities of the presidency. The first year has gone pretty quickly. Some of the number of regular things that you had to do, plus the challenges. And I wonder if you'd reflect a little bit with us about some of those. The things that interest me, of course, are walking into a situation that changed not just because you came and took charge, but also because of a new group of people in the legislature, a brand new group of people, a different party in control, the leaders who had for a long time understood the work of the university were replaced by people, good people, but people with different ideas and who didn't have that experience. And so reflect a little bit about the challenges that you faced and what you did to meet those challenges.
Well, I think it was an interesting time for many of the members of the legislature, because there were a lot of new members. There were 40 plus new members out of 170 in the body, so there was a substantial number. 25% or so of the legislative body were brand new. But in addition to that, you had new leadership in both the House and the Senate as the majority party changed. And so as a result of that, you had new committee chairs for all the committees. And so you had people that were...
So you're new and they're new.
Yeah, and you had people coming into leadership positions on committees that had varying levels of experience with both the state budget but with the university budget. And, of course, our budget's pretty complex, and the state budget's complex. And so I think there was certainly a learning curve for them and for me. And though I knew a number of them before the session began, there were some I didn't. And so getting to know the leadership and the committee chairs and trying to develop a working relationship with them took obviously a substantial amount of time. We did a lot of work, I think, trying to help them get up to speed on our budget and to understand what we do and how we do it. I think there was a number of people with ideas that the university, had some fat and needed to be cut. And of course, we spent some time trying to help them understand the cuts that had already been made because we had taken substantial cuts previously and had reversions, well over half a billion dollars, somewhere over $500 million that had taken place before last year and nearly $600 million. And so helping them understand that we'd already had that cut and yet there was a feeling that we could cut even more. So we spent a fair amount of time trying to show what the effect of those of any new cuts would be and how we would try to deal with those so people would understand. I think the members of the General Assembly, the leadership was in a difficult position because they were coming into a state budget that had a substantial deficit that as a result of the global recession. And so they were going to have to cut things anyway. I think they had pledged not to raise taxes. And so most of the effort to balance the budget had to come on the cut side. So, we entered into the session understanding that we were going to take cuts. We were trying to ensure that both we had the flexibility to manage those, but also that we kept them at the lowest level possible. We worked hard. I think we tried to be good partners with the legislature. I don't believe in trying to point fingers at people because this is our state. We're all in this together, and the university is our university, and we've got to make it successful if we want to be a successful state. And so we tried hard to work with people, and I think we were successful in some ways, and in other ways, we wish we could have had a little different outcome. But, we ended up with $414 million in a flex cut, which was a substantial amount, obviously,
flexible meaning that
we get
you had that you that is you and the and your board of governors had the flexibility to decide where those cuts
allocate those cuts out among the campuses. Yes, and that's all of our campuses are different and they can manage their way through these tough times in different ways, and so having that management flexibility I think is important.
Let me just tell you excuse me for interrupting you, but one of the things that was extraordinary for me and maybe still hard for some people in Chapel Hill to understand, but there two things happened. One is that in the management of the flexible of assigning those to the cuts that Chapel Hill accepted or got a higher percentage of cuts than some of the other campuses. And yet, you didn't hear from the leadership at Chapel Hill. You didn't hear any complaints. There was this sort of, yes, that's true. We're sorry that had to happen, but we understand what happened. And this, for me, was a great tribute to you and to your colleagues that you could ask one part of the system to accept a greater percentage and then have them be not cheerful about it, but accepting and understanding. And how did you get there?
Well, I think, first of all, North Carolina, unlike we saw in some other states, Wisconsin and Oregon and others, where there was sometimes division between the large research universities and some of the other campuses. And, you know, Wisconsin's system almost broke up, and the leader of that system, of their main campus left as a result of the conflict that occurred there. And, you know, we didn't have that here. You know, then North Carolina's different. I think our chancellors are in this together. They understand the value of being part of a system. You know, there's a real strength there, and that they recognize. And so you enter into this with everybody understanding that being part of a system means that you may not get treated the same this time, but you're in this together, and we all have to understand that we're part of one university, and we are. This is the University of North Carolina, and our you know, 17 constituent institutions, and so they're pleased to be part of a system, and I think that's an important place to start. So that was helpful. Secondly, I think you know, our large campuses understand that they have some advantages, perhaps, that other campuses don't have in terms of their donor base and their endowments and their ability to track research dollars, and that provide them with resources to help you know, help them to be able to provide the quality education that we all want to provide. And so when we sat down to do this, we actually developed a modeling system with our chancellors. They took into account a number of factors, and it took into account factors like one that we call diseconomies of scale, because, you know, it's harder to run a smaller campus sometimes than a larger one, because you don't have the economies of scale, and you still have to have an admissions office, and you still have to have a, you know, an internal auditor, and you still have to have all the other offices that are required to run an institution, and yet you're not serving as many students, so you can't spread the cost out quite as easily. So, you know, that was one factor that we looked at, but there were a range of others. You know, we were interested in how many students that individual campuses had. They were on financial aid and that were on Pell Grants, for example. We looked at, you know, a number of factors like that in terms of the size of the student body and all sorts of other factors. And we put those together. They were weighted factors. We worked that model out with the chancellor, so they knew what the model was and agreed to the factors, and then we put the numbers in there, and they came out where they came out. You know, I think the other recognition on the Chapel Hill campus was that, you know, we have a very strong and successful healthcare system that is part of the university that has for years, not just this year, but for years, provided substantial support back to the operation of the medical school. We could not operate the medical school at the University of North Carolina were it not for the UNC health system.
So
for lots of reasons.
It's a profit center, sort of.
It generates revenue, net revenue.
And in the future, with all the adjustments in the healthcare system, is that something that we can hope will continue down the line, or is that at risk as well? Yeah, I didn't mean to get into this.
I mean, you know, I've learned a lot this year, and I one of the things I didn't necessarily fully understand when I took this job was that I was going to be responsible for running a health system and you know, running the three hospitals that we now have and the one we're building and the physician practices that we have associated with us and all the other parts of that health system. And so I've learned a lot about healthcare. And one of the things I think everybody's learned in the last year is we don't know the answer to the question you just asked because we don't know what the future of healthcare is. I think one of the exciting developments that we just saw open this week is our partnership with Blue Cross, in which, you know, we are trying to go into community, in this case, this community, and with a new model, a way of helping people get the care they need quickly and in less expensive environments, but also to really bring a focus to prevention and to monitor patients more closely and to be able to manage chronic disease better, so that we we can reduce costs. And I think that's a model that we'll see more of going forward. But, you know, where the health care reform in the United States goes, I think we all are up in the air, obviously. What the Supreme Court decides later this year will be a major impact about the health care law. But right now, our health care system is strong. It's an integrated system in which each part of it is very important to us. And, for example, we couldn't do the support of the medical school if we didn't have our hospital in Raleigh. They're key components to it. But we're also, as you know, expanding our medical school operations into other communities where we're training third and fourth year medical students in Charlotte and in Nashville. That program's going quite well, and it's a much less expensive way of being able to produce more doctors, which the state needs as it grows. So we're hopeful that we will continue to be able to generate enough net revenue in our healthcare system to be able to support the medical school in a strong way. And so part of what happened this year was I asked the healthcare system to step up and do even more for the university. And so some of that money was able to, the university itself was able to save some money that would have otherwise gone to the medical school, and that helped it absorb the little bit higher percentage of cuts that they took. And so, that arrangement, I think, was helpful in everybody making it through this. And so we came out in a place where this was hard on everybody, but I hope we came out in a way that was as fair as possible to all of our campuses and allowed them to absorb what have been very difficult cuts. And we've watched closely and tried to keep good data on what the effect of the cuts are, and not so we can whine and complain, but because we need to know so we know where our weak points are and we can address those. Because my responsibility, more than anything else, is to ensure that the University of North Carolina remains one of the best public university systems in the world. We have to maintain quality. If quality slips, then you can get in a downward spiral in a hurry, and you can begin to have enrollment problems, which will generate revenue problems, which will create all sorts of issues in terms of being able to attract faculty and all those things. So you really have to be careful, and higher education is a fragile business. It's reputational in many ways. It's about trying to bring in the best and the brightest faculty and the best and the brightest students. But it's also about access and affordability and being able to give students who are bright an opportunity for a future that they might not have. And
those things begin to pile up on you.
They do.
Let's take a quick break, and we'll come back to that. Yes, yeah. With Tom Ross, the president of the University of North Carolina. He and I'll be right back.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with DG Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is DG Martin. Tom Ross, the president of the University of North Carolina, and I are visiting. And I interrupted you when we got off on the solid challenge, and I think maybe for me, as I look at your job and worry about it, is maintaining quality, maintaining access and affordability, living up to the constitutional standard and the high traditions of of our university and our state, and providing as nearly as practical free of cost education to our students that has paid off for us. But you're caught really in a vice about that. I found out when I was working with the university that the campuses couldn't be trusted to manage tuition policy on their own, because the management of the university, the leadership of the universities and the boards of the universities were focused, had to be, primarily on quality. And the only revenue source that they could manage was tuition, if they were allowed to manage it. And there were always quality concerns that could be solved by increased income. So I mean, I'm one of those who don't trust campuses to manage this. You apparently do.
Well, I think you have to. Life is about a balance. you know, in all candor, I think almost everything we face in life is you end up having to balance pros and cons and trying to figure out where the right place to come out, you know. And I think a system of checks and balances like we have in North Carolina is really important, where the campuses go through an extensive tuition process where they involve students, they involve faculty, they involve their trustees, and they come forward with a recommendation to the Board of Governors. It's then our responsibility to pull all those recommendations from the campuses together and try to bring something to our board that is consistent with our policies, but is also the right balance between the needs of the campus to maintain quality and the need of affordability and access. And I think, you know, that is a challenge, and it's an increasing challenge. You know, when you absorb the kind of cuts we've absorbed, and you've seen the effect of some of those cuts, you do worry about where we're headed in terms of quality. And yet, we're in a very difficult economic time still in this state and in this nation, and we're going to be for a while, I fear. And so trying to balance, you know, what can you do in terms of putting more burden on the backs of students and parents in order to maintain that quality in the environment in which you are now living. And so when I look out and see, you know, what the potential is for more state revenue, and when I look at the cuts we've taken, even if we increase tuition at a, you know, $500, let's say, or $600, as some campuses are projecting, you know, we're only going to generate revenue-wise for the system, you know, maybe 15% of what we lost just last year. So we're not going to fill this hole that we've been digging out of. We're not going to fill it just by increasing tuition. We can't. You know, we can't recover, and we never will probably recover all of those dollars. You know, part of the way we have to do this is by more cuts, more efficiencies, more back office coordination so that we can save money. I mean, we've got to be more efficient and more innovative. So that's part of what we have to do. But we've got some pretty critical holes right now. We've got students who can't get classes they need. We have faculty that are being asked to do sometimes not only teach more courses, but teach more students in the courses, and that's putting a great burden on them. We've got faculty and staff, most of whom have had no raise for 4 years, and who have families to support themselves, and who often have students that are in our campuses. So, you know, it's a very tough environment right now.
And back away for just a second. I mean, this is so critically important. I hate to interrupt you about this, but transfer this thinking to sort of the nationwide problem that the country faces in terms of figuring out a way to provide affordable higher education to what I think, I mean, maybe you would argue with this, a growing need for both in terms of the number of people and the time that higher education will take, the added expense, the transfer of that expense to the students, the loading up of debt, and it looks like, I mean, we're squeezing ourselves to death while other countries have figured out a way to increase the college-going rate or the amount of higher education somehow. How do you back away from your special responsibilities in this state and to this university, and how's the nation? Are there creative ways that the nation can to meet the challenge that it faces? What you're thinking about that?
Yeah, you know, it's I think it in the United States, what has made us the world's best economy, I think many would agree, is the competitive edge we have when we have the best higher education system in the world, and when we have, as somebody mentioned to me last night, more Nobel laureates. This is a person from another country, by the way. We have more Nobel laureates. We are a place known for quality research, that we produce new ideas and new discoveries. Everybody you talk to says we've got to innovate our way out of this tough economic situation we're in. And I, at the same time, there seems to be a loss of focus on the importance of education in America, and at virtually every level, but particularly in higher education. And we're seeing in every state cuts in terms of what we're doing for higher education. And I believe that if we're going to continue to be a competitive economy, if we're going to be the kind of strong country that we want to be, we must invest in our future. And there is nothing more important than higher education, because the jobs of the future, we know right now, every economist predicts that there's going to be a higher percentage of jobs that require post-secondary education than ever before. In just a few years, more than 50% of the jobs in this state will be jobs that require post-secondary education. And yet we're nowhere near that educated as a populace. And so we've got to do a better job of educating more people. We're also still a growing state, so we're going to have more people that are coming to us through population growth that are going to need to be educated. So we've got to invest in education.
Is there a way to do it? I mean, can you envision a way in which, I don't want to say the Walmart model, but is there a way consistent with the consistent but not exactly like the way we've provided quality with 16, 17 campuses in a traditional education model? Is anybody thinking about how we could do this
differently?
Differently, maybe not quite as well, but still gain the kinds of quantity that we need.
Sure, I think there's a lot of people around the country thinking about this. You know, certainly technology is going to be part of the solution, and we're looking hard at that. And how we offer a large number of degree programs online already. We're going to be looking at that. I think we've got to reinvent the way we teach. I think that's part of it, is that we've seen some evidence around the country that using new methodologies and new techniques in classrooms provide for greater student success. I think we have to keep a focus on student progress. We really have to, set policies in a way that will encourage students to move through as quickly as possible. But that means we've got to have the courses available, which is one of the issues we're facing. But I think there are a lot of different things that we've got to do differently if we're going to meet the challenge. But we also are going to have to continue to invest. And I think that's the difference between what we're doing now in the United States, where we are actually de-investing in higher education as a nation as compared to many other countries. And,
when you see India. Yeah, go ahead.
I just want to tell you, when you see India, who has 3% of their population with four-year degrees, saying they want to get to 25% in 10 years, and they're talking about building 1,000 new universities. Yeah. That's a focus on education we don't have.
Yeah. I know you're swamped, but come back and let's talk about that. I want to take a break and then come back and talk about something that maybe people in Chapel Hill are even more interested in, that's athletics.
Okay.
Chapelboro.com. Go there quick and stay a while. Chapelboro.com. More of what you live here for. And now back to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin on News Talk 1360 WCHL.
Welcome back. Who's talking? This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with UNC President Tom Ross, and we talked about, and I would love to continue to talk about Tom. Wonderful and stimulating conversation about the future of higher education. But when you talk about higher education in North America, most people are really talking about competitive athletics, football and basketball, and so that's got to be part of your business. I've heard you say the Board of Governors has delegated primary responsibility of athletics to the campuses. Does that keep you out of NCAA investigations and policy matters and hiring coaches? Can you just back away and say we're letting the campuses do all of that?
You are sometimes pulled into those issues, whether you want to be or not. I mean, it's part of my responsibility, is to work with each of our chancellors. They report to me, and so they are. I work with each of them, and so it's important that we not interfere with what is both a Board of Governors policy, but also an NCAA policy, that's left to the campus and left to the chancellor. And so I don't get involved in trying to dictate decisions one way or the other, or who ought to be hired or who ought to be retained. I think I'm always there to talk to chancellors and try to provide advice, and talked to one yesterday, not in Chapel Hill, about an athletic situation that they have. And I've talked to several around the state. I mean, we've seen a change in the football program at Western Carolina this year. And so, there are those things that are going on campuses a lot. And I sometimes get asked my advice about them, but certainly don't interfere with the decisions. On the other hand, the Board of Governors still does have a role to play. They're certain if contracts contain certain provisions, then they're required to come to the Board of Governors for approval. So the board is not given up all of its responsibility and shouldn't. It still has that oversight responsibility.
The Board of Governors approves football coaches?
It under certain circumstances, it does. Well, I mean, if it depends on what the terms of the contract are. There's certain requirements of, you know, buyout provisions or whatever it might be that under certain conditions that we've set out in our policies are required to come to the Board of Governors. And so, you know, they're going to be involved. And, of course, whenever there's Board of Governor involvement, then I'm involved, you know. And so, you know, it's not something that you can completely stay away from, nor should you. But by the same token, most of the decision making happens on the campus.
What about the whole thing? Do you worry that there's a bubble in athletics and the economic rewards and consequent disincentives, I guess, as well, that all of this threatens higher education and public higher education in North Carolina, and if the bubble is the burst of the bubble imminent, if you think there is a bubble?
I don't know if there's a bubble. You know, I think that one has to recognize that certainly the commercial side of college athletics is the barn door is open on that, and we're not going to be able to close it. You know, even if we wanted to, it's you know, the American public is too interested in college basketball and football, and they're not going to let us shut the door and in the commercial side of it.
Just so you and I are handicapped because we're part of that American public that loves athletics, and therefore handicaps us to some degree in being objective about whether or not the role of it is positive or negative. And
yeah, I'll tell you. You know, I hear you, and I think it maybe I'm not as objective as I should be, but I think I am. And I, you know, part of what helps me with objectivity is, as you know, I've been part of a Division I program that, you know, I think adds tremendously to the school and to the culture of the institution. But I don't think many would call it, in terms of the money and the commercialization of it, big time athletics. So, you know, and I'm somebody who believes athletics have an important role to play for campuses. You know, they part of what is great about a college experience is being a fan, and so in building that loyalty, and the loyalty that's sometimes built through athletics pays off in terms of donations to institutions in a big way. So I think, and not just to the athletic program. I mean, institutions you'll see.
I'm with you on this.
Yeah,
and it's not the right place to end, but the clock is run. We're just getting started on this.
I mean, I think it is a big issue, and it's one that we have to pay attention to. And I think the universities and colleges have a role to play in keeping appropriate boundaries on it, and that's what we've got to focus on. You know, you're not going to end it, so how do you control it and put boundaries on it that don't impact academics? And that's what we've got to focus on.
Thanks for visiting. I wish we could keep on going. You got to run to a meeting, and our time is over. Thanks to President Tom Ross. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking. We'll be back here before you know it.